Hi, and welcome to You Love to See It, the FanBite podcast, where we watch things and then talk about them. pretty simple premise, really. I'm Merritt Kay, features and trending editor at FanBite.com. And joining me this week are Danielle Riando,
Hi.
EIC of FanBite. Hello.
Hi, that's me. I'm excited
that's
to talk
you.
About this. It's me.
That's you.
It's a me.
And Steven Strom, managing editor of FanBite.com.
Hi, the Tegu liker has logged on.
Excellent.
And this week we are discussing Kim Ji-woon's The Good, the Bad, the Weird, a 2008 Korean Western action movie, which I actually first saw back in, I want to say 2009, 2010. I think this was one of the first movies I rented on Netflix when Netflix was still DVD based.
Oh, shit.
Wow.
Yep. Because when I moved to the States back then, back in 2009, I was like, oh, Netflix, we don't have this. What is this? And what is Hulu? Because Canada didn't have any of those things back then and still
sure.
doesn't have Hulu or some other things. But
wait. That would be a total tangent if I went on to this, but that just blows my mind.
We have different ones that are bad, mostly. There was a whole thing for a few years where, like, Canadians were using proxies to get American Netflix, and the telecom companies in Canada were like, hey, don't do that. And people were just like, no, we're going to keep doing that.
Wow.
Anyway... The Good, the Bad, the Weird premiered at the 2008 Cannes Film Festival. It had a limited release in 2010 in the U.S. and received pretty positive reviews, mostly focusing on the action and the cinematography.
Yeah.
And it's the second collaboration between the director, Kim Ji-woon, and the actor who plays the bad, Lee Byung-hoon, who could... literally kill me, and I would be like, so they've worked together before this, and they worked together again after it in Kim's I Saw the Devil in 2010.
Oh,
very
okay.
Nice. Okay.
Oh, have you seen that?
I've not seen it, but I'm familiar with it.
Okay, cool. So was this everyone's first time watching this movie? Like I said, I've seen it before, but I didn't remember a lot of it because it was like 10 years ago. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same for me. First time viewer, long time listener.
Cool.
Yeah.
And now I haven't seen the film that inspired this movie, which is of course Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah. Mm.
Have either of you seen that?
Oh yes.
About 750 times.
Whoa. Whoa.
Sergio Leone movies were like, it was Sergio Leone and James Bond were like the two like bonding experience movies I had with me and my dad. We have very different tastes on most things, but like The Good, Bad, the Ugly, the basically the whole Man with No Name trilogy plus Once Upon a Time in the West were like huge in our household, like for sure.
Nice. Not nearly as many times, but it was definitely something I watched on like a Sunday afternoon because it was on whatever channel with my dad. You know, kind of hanging out. Like, we watched a lot of movies that way, and that's where I got my appreciation of Westerns as well. But probably not 750 times. I cannot top that for sure.
Well, you know, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I don't have my backloggery profile open right now to tell you.
Good. Good. Very good.
So, the basic structure of this movie is that everyone wants this map.
Yeah.
And, what the map is exactly is not really that important. It turns out to be a map to an oil field, I guess.
Spoilers for the very end of the movie.
Spoilers for the very end of the movie. It doesn't matter, though, because the map is just the thing that everyone's after. It's like the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
It's the Maltese Falcon. And the three main characters that are pursuing it are the good, played by Jung Woo-sung, who is sort of like a classic cowboy bounty hunter figure. He's like the Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
kind of.
Totally. He's the blondie, the man with no name type character for sure.
Right. And then we have the bad, who is the aforementioned Lee Byung-hoon, who is this bandit and hitman and kind of just like general sociopath.
yep.
And just, we'll talk about the costume design later because it's one of my favorite yep. parts of this movie. And finally, Yoon Tae-gu, the weird, who is played by one of my favorite actors, actually, Song Kang-ho.
Yes.
Who listeners may know from Parasite, or from that vampire movie. Yes. Was that called Thirst?
I think it's Thirst.
Which Danielle and I watched a couple of months ago. And
he's like in all of that guy's movies. Like, he's in Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. He's in Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. He's in The Host.
And he is
here
in the
playing a kind of goofball character who has like a darker past beneath his like weird kind of happy-go-lucky persona.
Yeah.
So that's the setting. It's set in Manchuria in 1939. And I want to talk just a little bit briefly about Manchuria.
Yeah.
Because I think probably a lot of people watching this movie don't really know that much about the setting. And you don't really have to. They sort of explain that Manchuria, which is actually called Manchukuo, like generally speaking.
Yeah.
Is a puppet state of the Japanese Empire that was founded in 1932. And it was founded illegally by the Japanese Empire. So it wasn't recognized by the League of Nations, which later became the UN, I believe.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the setting is, or a lot of the characters and world in this movie are informed by that setting, which is like this puppet state, this illegitimate state that is very ethnically diverse. So... Manchukuo was populated by mainly Han Chinese, but also Koreans, and the Manchu people who it's named after were a minority. And then also Japanese, Mongols, and White Russians, who are Russians who fled Russia during the revolution. And it was a strange and chaotic kind of place. One thing about the government there is that it was formed by a lot of intellectuals from Japan who were disillusioned with Japanese policies and thought that they could create a better society and legal system in Manchukuo.
Mm.
Didn't really work out that way.
Yeah.
A lot of bad shit and weird shit going on. So there's the scene in the movie where there is a guy who is pretending to be a Korean independence fighter who says that they're funding the fight for independence with the opium trade, when in fact he is actually working with the Japanese. So there is a Japanese paramilitary group called the Black Dragon Society, which was this ultra-nationalist far-right group that that intentionally distributed opium in Manchukuo to basically pacify and make the population easier to control.
Hmm.
And also kind of did this thing where they were like, oh, everyone living here is like our Manchu people now, like even the Han Chinese. Like, so this was sort of the Japanese Empire's attempt to gain a foothold in China. And Manchu is actually the homeland of the Qing Dynasty emperors. And the last Qing Dynasty emperor was, I believe, installed as like a figurehead to sort of create more of a sense of legitimacy. Didn't work. And ultimately collapsed. But I just wanted to give some background on the setting there. So,
that's awesome. Like, I mean, it's not awesome history, but like, it's a cool lesson. Like, I had heard of the phrase Manchuria many times before this, obviously, but like, I did a little bit of like Googling about it while we were watching this movie, just so I had some context. But like, even then, I still didn't know like any of that stuff. And you can actually see, I think, a lot of what you just said permeate a lot of what's going on in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, for as early as that like first train scene where everybody just has these amazing costumes, that's like such a weird, wild, diverse range of different like looks and feels for all these different characters on this train that gets heisted early on and creates this like really, really colorful kind of look at everything, that then immediately goes to shit because the bad of the movie hijacks the train and tries to like steal this map for a guy who, I don't know if we ever really learn what his deal is, do we? Like, his sort of patron in this movie, he's like working for the Japanese government in some capacity.
The bad's
like sort of patron guy who he's working for at the beginning. The bat is like a hired gun. Yeah, he works for somebody.
Yeah, he hires him. Yeah, to get the map.
But he says he took him in when he was like a kid or something like that and trained him.
When he was in a bad place, drunk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple of last things about Manchu Kuo. Basically, the Japanese Empire intentionally spread that term to create a sense of legitimacy. And in current scholarly practice, the use of that term is kind of fallen out of favor, in favor of just the Northeast, describing the region of China. And in China, actually, to this day, when people talk about Manchu Kuo, they preface it with the word Wei, which means like so-called. Fake. So like the fake Manchuria, basically.
And
very complex, a lot of really interesting history, a lot of like bad stuff that happened. I would encourage people to read more about it if they enjoyed the movie, because a lot of interesting history there.
Yeah,
absolutely. It feels very much, this is not, I'm sure this is very much intentional, but it feels almost, the setting itself feels almost of a piece with Indiana Jones, like a place in conflict, a place in the middle of kind of war happening, a lot of things happening, a lot of very, very bad people doing terrible things. And we have like this adventure in the middle of it. It's certainly not an Indiana Jones movie by any means, but some pieces of that kind of stuck out for me. Like having this wild adventure in the midst of just the world being reformed and changed by horrible people and big forces like around it.
It's like even literally like on the eve of World War II, basically, like from a political standpoint, the way that like Raiders of the Lost Ark is, because I think that takes place pre-World War II.
I believe so, too. It's like right before. Very much, of a piece with that as well. And also some of the sort of adventures in the desert kind of scenes and like the visual iconography of it, even though it's a very different desert. It's a very different, you know, kind of thing that's going on, but it felt, and also just maybe sort of the spirit of the movie, because it's a very fun movie, even though it's happening in this like pretty dark and uneasy kind of time in this puppet state. Like it's like a really, like cheerful movie in a lot of ways, or at least a lot of it is like very like comedic and even slapstick at points. So it has some of that vibe to it that I found really interesting and actually pretty appealing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, Tegu, I think is despite the fact that he comes last in the name order for this movie, is probably the heart and soul of the movie.
He's
and
the main
he is,
character, basically.
Oh, yeah.
100%. Yeah.
Because we follow him for most of the movie. So, yeah, I mean, with regard to the plot, I think there isn't actually that much to say. Because it's,
sure.
It's in ways kind of complicated because you're sort of tracking like who is working for whom. And like there's double crosses and things like that. But ultimately, it's pretty straightforward in that these three people want this thing. And then everyone else also wants this thing. There's a group of bandits that are sort of just like this comic relief group who are just sort of following from a distance and just watching like this just horse shit happen. And then there's also the Japanese army shows up later. So it's everyone wants this thing. And it's basically just a chase to get the map and then get to where the map leads.
Yeah.
I think actually one of the, I don't even know if I would call it a problem so much as it's just like an unexpected thing in this style of movie. Cause I feel like there is a blueprint for this style of like mad world style, like chase across the world storyline that we see in the West a lot. Where it's like every single faction is going to have a very unique identity and a very unique specific thing, and they'll be kind of one-dimensional, so you can keep track of them. This movie doesn't really have that, so it does get easy to lose track of people, but at the same time, I think like they just work better as a backdrop for the three main characters a little bit more. More Tegu and Chang-Yi, because I think actually
Do-won is like the least characterized of these three characters for sure. Yeah. He's just like the good guy.
Not on screen very much, even. Like,
just a good man
just
cowboy.
Drops out of the movie.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's a good jumping off point to talk about the character designs because they're so fun and like so great.
Yeah.
So we talked about how Park Dong-won is this like classic cowboy. He wears a duster. He has this cowboy hat. He has this like long rifle. He rides a horse. But then Chang Yi is this really striking figure because he wears like this suit, but mm-hmm. he doesn't wear like a suit, like fully done up and everything. He has the kind of like badass thing of like the top button is open and like the collar is sort of spread over his suit jacket.
Right.
And his whole like bearing, his screen presence is so strong, partly because I think that costume really sticks out against like the browns and the sandy background, but also just because of the way he moves. Like, it's like he is, it's an archetype that I've seen a lot in anime of like this kind of evil character who's just like, and like, you know, will just be standing there with their head cocked back and then like very suddenly like shoot someone and then just go back to looking like disinterested. And
holding a knife jauntily in one hand while he walks towards somebody, which he does multiple times literally in this movie.
And it's so effective to characterize him as just like a bad guy.
He also has a lot of earrings and is like very like Final Fantasy haircut as well. Like very
he looks like a Final Fantasy 15 character.
He does.
And he has, I think, some like makeup on as well, just to like make his eyes look a little darker. He has this little like thin mustache. Sometimes he'll like take his jacket off and then he's wearing a waistcoat.
Yes.
And has these gloves, which are kind of important later on as we like realize the truth behind them. But his whole like, his definitely like product styled hair.
Yes.
And his like smoking cigarettes and just like dressing in this like kind of snappy way. Like really contrasts him with the other two characters. Like he is like, feels very strongly like a city mouse kind of character, like someone who is adapting to the changes that are happening around him and just basically doing whatever it takes to survive. Even if that means like blending in and like looking refined, then he'll do that. Whereas the other two characters are sort of more like traditional Western looking, except Taegu is not exactly that.
Yeah. He's often wearing a lot of interesting headgear in this movie. Like,
He has several pilot hats. Yeah.
Yeah. Constantly different. Like, the like 30s style aeronautic hats. A diving bell for one extended sequence.
Oh my God, that's very good. This is so cool. Why is it so heavy?
It's so good. That's maybe one of my favorite bits in the whole movie, actually. It's like the extended, like fucking slapstick sequence of him with the diving bell on his head, just being like, oh, this is armor. I'm doing it. Like, he's a really fun character, a really interesting character. And I do like how different their styles are and how much they are differentiated in terms of not just costume design, but like you're saying, like movement and even like speech and like cadence and everything like that. Like they're like, I actually feel for Wu Sung who plays Dawan, because like there's not that much to do when you're just a good guy. Like you're he's just like, oh, a good guy. Like there's not that much kind of going on there, whereas of course like with the other characters, like they have so much like scenery chewing stuff to do and so much, you know, like being weird and being funny or being so bad that just like looks like such a pleasure to play and to do that. So I almost worry that like Dawan doesn't have that much of a character. He just does good things. And it's like, okay, that's fine. Like it's fine. It's not like he's a tortured hero or anything like that. He's just a cowboy.
He's an archetype.
That's actually one place where I think the movie sort of is let down by its direct comparisons to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, because Blondie, like the man with no name in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, has a lot of definition to him for being the like good character. Because he's this like weird sort of grifter who, like, in that movie, his whole shtick at the beginning is that he's got this whole racket where he picks a partner, works with them, they go into a town, get a bounty on their heads, he turns them in as the bounty hunter, and then when they're about to hang them in town, he shoots the rope down, and then they move to another town and repeat the same process.
So he's like, kind of the thief, right, bandit, kind of. He's kind of both, you know, things, yeah, going on. So if you're separating that into three distinct archetypes and three distinct characters, it's almost like, oh, you gave one person all the fun stuff to do, as right, opposed to kind of like combining those things. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But yeah, this whole fight in the ghost market really, like, I think it gives Jo-Wan some stuff to do, like, visually, but also, like, it's so hard to do. This is going to sound like a tangent, but it circles back around. But, like, it's so hard to do, like, violence with guns in a way that is interesting and fun to watch,
sure,
on screen.
Yeah.
It's, like, one of the problems with, like, a lot of Jackie Chan movies a lot of times, like, in his later career, where it's just, like, the bad guy ends up getting defeated by a gun. You know, they just get shot,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And they do that same thing here in this movie during the ghost market scene, but they do a lot of, like, really good build up using Tegu, where there's that whole scene where he's getting his ass kicked by the really big guy with the hammer.
Yeah.
Oh, he's like in it.
Yeah, the guy with the dreadlocks.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that character's name is Bear.
I love him.
Okay. And he is played by Ma Dong Suk, who you might know from Train to Busan.
Hell yeah.
Oh,
hell,
I still haven't,
yes,
seen that,
I
yet.
I know,
but
he looks
that's
super
cool.
Familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He is. Yeah, he doesn't have much of a role in this movie, but maybe we'll do Train to Busan at some point, because that's one
we
of the few
to.
Zombie movies that I actually really like, and he
I
is
really
so good
it.
In it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great film. Yeah.
But yeah, there's that fight with him in this movie where Do-Wan is like sniping people from off of a rooftop, and meanwhile, Tegu is just getting like, you see a shack in the background, and then Tegu's like head just bursts through the top of the roof of the shack because he's been like pushed out. So you don't see like the majority of this actual fight. And he's like, throw me a gun. And Do-Wan just like kind of lackadaisically like tosses guns in his direction, but not in a way that he can actually pick them up. And there's a whole fight built around it, which ends with him just like shooting Bear like,
yeah,
to death off screen. But they do such a good buildup of him getting his ass kicked and having fun with it and stuff like that. Like, they don't really give a lot of that to Do-Wan. Do-Wan, whenever he's on screen, his entire character archetype is just competent. He's just
right.
good at what
yeah,
he does.
He's just good at his job.
Yeah.
And Song Kang-ho is just like so fun in this movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, he just gets to be like a real goofball who's just like, ah, like people are shooting at him and he's just like jumping up and down like a cartoon character. Like, he is basically like a cartoon character for most of this movie in terms of just like his reactions and the way he acts and his character, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like his character design communicates a lot because this is a guy who's like fled from his old life, basically. And he has like all of these packs and like he has this like a motorcycle with a sidecar with like all kinds of stuff in it. So he's like this kind of like nomadic guy who's carrying all of this shit with him. Mm. And, you know, unlike, Park Do-Wan, who is sort of just like this lone cowboy with a horse and like a pretty streamlined design. Tegu literally has baggage, like, which is sort of his metaphorical baggage is slowly kind of revealed over the course of the movie. But there is this kind of side plot where we learn that Park Do-Wan is pursuing Chang-Yi because he believes him to be the Finger Chopper, who is this notorious killer who, you know, chops off people's fingers.
And, oh, word? Yeah. I've missed that when I watched.
No, it's just a name. of course, it later turns out that Tegu is actually the Finger Chopper, and he kind of lets the mask drop at the end of the movie when it's revealed that Chang-Yi has been chasing him this whole time, not just to get the map, but because he cut his finger off in a knife fight and beat him. And he's kind of obsessed, like his character motivation is just being the best and just like he wants to just like be better than everybody else and prove that he's better. So he's obsessed with Tegu and is chasing him like across the country.
Yeah.
The reveal that Tegu is the Finger Chopper and is like actually the most competent gunslinger in the entire country is also just a deeply anime reveal at the end here.
Yeah. Top 10 anime betrayals. He's just, like the scene where so basically the climax of the movie is Chang-Yi catches up to the other two characters and says like, oh, I've lost everything, like all of my men are dead. So here's a game we're going to play. Like we'll do a three-way duel and whoever lives is the best. And then he like, Taigo is like, no, I don't care about being the best. You be the best. Like, why does that matter? Best. It doesn't matter at all. It's like, get out of my face. And, Chang-Yi is just kind of goading him into it by shooting his hat as he's trying to pick it up. And then he's like, how about treasure? Would you fight for treasure? And he's just like, no, I don't care. Just like, leave me alone. I'm too old for this shit. And finally, you know, goads him into it when he like takes his glove off and reveals that he has like a metal finger. And there's that great bit of him like holding it up and like the wind whistling through it.
Yeah.
And this also, this whole scene is like the most direct that the Sergio Leone like connections start to come in. Like the shooting the hat over and over again thing is straight out of.
Yeah.
I think I want to say that's either A Fistful of Dollars or For a Few Dollars More. The three-way Mexican standoff. The you dig. Why am I the only one digging? Like this whole thing is just straight up out of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Even the shots of their faces, which people might know from the meme. Of the faces all flipping between them over and over and over again as they stare at each other.
Yeah, I want to say that this sequence is honestly one of like the very few truly Western kinds of sequences in the whole movie. I really think of this as like action adventure comedy that just happens to have a lot of like fun Western trappings, like fun Western clothes and a lot of, you know, like great shots of the desert and things like that. But like the pacing and the style and the, you know, the so much of it like that. It's one of the main points for me for this movie. I think this movie is utterly beautiful. It's shot so beautifully. It's so incredible that actually it got a little exhausting for me at times. Like I genuinely had to watch this in like a couple of settings because
I split
it's
it up
so
into
much.
Two.
Yeah. Which is not like a bad thing. I'm not trying to knock this movie. I think it's gorgeous. It's just very rich. And Westerns are generally known for being very spare and sparse in their cinematography, like really kind of showing just huge vistas, right? With only a few people maybe in them. Like a lot of very, very kind of spare shots that is beautiful in its own way. But so much of the movie is like this super, super, super rich and dense shots and like so much action and so much stuff packed into one frame that like, oh, it was like, oh my God, okay, here it's a Western. Even though it's like other genres everywhere else, but here
it's
in this
very
shootout,
urban for a Western.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Dense.
Because, and so many of the fights take place like in settlements and in cities.
Yeah. Or in a train, which I guess is
or
also
on a train. Which
that's
is
also
Western.
Pretty Western. Yeah. For
God,
to be fair.
I fucking love a train heist. It's like just train movies. I mean, talking about train movies, Snowpiercer, which we did a while ago.
Yeah.
Also Song
also
Kong.
Has
incredible.
Another thing too, like in terms of the Western comparison is like, again, like you said, Danielle, this movie's just like nonstop, fully packed with stuff. Whereas in especially Sergio Leone movies are like 90% build up and then 10% payoff and like spread across 3 hours. Whereas in this movie, the literal worst thing you can be in The Good, the Bad, the Weird is a crowd. Because you're just immediately going to get shot by 30 bullets by a guy from across the map or something like that. Like, there's like just tons of scenes of just people getting fucking wasted by machine guns. And they're like early on, Taegu basically bursts into one of the train cars with a bunch of Japanese soldiers and just like single-handedly murders 11 of them. Whereas that is just like not what Westerns used to do very much. And then, like on top of that, this movie is 2 hours long, or it's 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a very packed, very long movie. And I totally understand why you might, you know, want to take a break.
Yeah. And it's not a problem with pacing. Like I, you know, there's plenty of that good kind of roller coaster effect of up and down, you know, rising action, falling action, you know, plenty of conversations by firesides and in campsites and things like that are very good for that. It's just, honestly, I think for me, just an artifact of being like this richly framed and and shot and with like this much detail. Like I kept kind of pausing to just look at shots because it's fucking gorgeous. Like this is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful movie. So well shot. I think it was one of the most expensive movies ever made in Korea at the time. And it shows, like, just in terms of like, oh, they built that whole set. Holy Christ, you know, like, oh, they built all of this. Oh, they actually, like, you know, had incredible, incredible, you know, resources put into things like costume and prop design to make everything look like very colorful, very saturated, very like just amazingly composed.
There's that one shot when they first go to the ghost market, which I don't think we've talked about yet, but it's like the thieves basically, I don't know, like it's a black market where people sell stolen goods to each other.
Yeah.
And when they first enter the ghost market, there's that really good shot that really stuck out to me because it says so much about this world and this universe and like the state of like where it is historically, that just talks about like banditry and, you know, colonialism and all this other stuff. Yeah. Without necessarily saying it because this movie's just not interested in making that textual. But when Tegu walks into the ghost market for the first time, they're like carrying away a like fully excavated like Buddha statue, like a I forget, I don't think it's Buddha, but it's like it's some religious figure, and it's like this 80 ton giant stone statue that they're just like hauling away, implying that like just regular ass thieves have stolen some giant cultural artifact and are just like there to hawk it. And that's like the scale of stuff that we're talking about now. This is like, you know, like mid to late 30s, early 40s is when about this movie takes place. And it's just that era of like the old world is being completely consumed by like mechanization, industrialization and all that stuff, and colonialized, like colonialism in general, as it turns out. But also it just looks super, super striking on screen because it just gets across the scale of, you know, what this movie is trying to evoke in a very fun way to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, I want to talk about the camera work that portrays all this stuff a little more, because there are so many like camera effects, like so many uses of zooms and pans. And I think they did like some interesting stuff with the camera for like filming some of the action scenes and the chase scenes. Like they had the camera like alongside the actors. I'm not really, because I don't know enough about how camera work in movies actually works to speak to this, but Danielle, like, can you maybe talk about some of the techniques that you saw used there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, any action sequence is probably gonna have like hundreds of shots, and they like, it could be any mix of techniques. You might have some handheld stuff, or you might have some like Steadicam stuff, and you might have some crane shots. I imagine they used a lot of cranes in making this, and actually like that gets that like big swooping effect a lot of the time, like smooth kind of swooping effect stuff happens usually with cranes or something like a crane shot. So yeah, I saw a lot of that. And there's just a lot of camera movement, especially in these scenes and in, like, I'm thinking also of like the opium den scene where like we're always constantly panning or zooming or tracking just kind of around at what's going on and how much stuff is going on. So yeah, it's probably a really, really, really dense and intense mixture. And I would have loved to, I mean, this is me with every movie, right? But like, I would have loved to like sat in the cutting room and like see what they decide to use and what gets cut and what like, you know, gets kind of put together with what, because that's my favorite part of filmmaking secretly is editing.
Yeah.
Cause it's just so incredible.
No, it's great. That's movies are made in the cut, right?
Exactly. Like, so much stuff is, but yeah, it's so, 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 I think this is part of what made me tired at times and have to watch it in like different kind of bits and pieces. But I will sit there like not counting shots, but sometimes I will sit there and count shots and like think about like, okay, we're going from this close up to this wide shot, to this medium shot, to this crane shot, to this, to this, to this, to this. And like, good Lord, the amount of kind of stuff on the screen and the amount of work that goes into making that very readable, because it is extremely readable given how much action is happening. Like they may have had to have like, you know, three units on this, like doing different stuff with like various shots and various like camera techniques. So I'm so fucking impressed by all of this, I guess is the way I'll sum that up.
On that note, actually, I just wanted to make sure we mentioned it, because I think that you could probably speak to this better than any of us. But I know Colin wanted us to talk about the intro to the movie. Colin couldn't be with us on this week's episode, despite the fact that he loves this movie, too. But he says here in the show notes that do me a favor. Just make sure it's mentioned on the pod how much I love this movie's opening sequence and the score.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. OK, so the score. I forgot that Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood was in this movie. And when that hits, it's like, it hits during like the big chase at the end when like the army is chasing them and like the bandits are chasing them and Park Chang-yi's gang is chasing them. And it's just so good. This instrumental arrangement of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, the Nina Simone / Animals hit that... Like, I just love that song generally, but like the way that it's used here is like so perfect.
So good. It's so, so good.
Yeah.
I'm going back and watching the intro here. Sorry, go ahead. I'm just watching it as we chat about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, like the movie in general, the music is actually like, I find pretty striking just by virtue of like every time a song starts in this movie, it sounds like an Ennio Morricone. I can never remember if it's Ennio Morricone or if it's just Ennio Morricone, but the composer for most of Sergio Leone's movies, he did basically every spaghetti western you've ever seen. He probably did he did the Ecstasy of Gold, which is the big like song from Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yes.
A lot of the music in this movie starts off that way, with that very like like kind of driving beat to it that Ennio Morricone used to do. I hope I'm saying his name right.
He's like, Italian, so okay. If you want to do it like the Italian way, it would be Morricone, but
Morricone.
Yeah.
It's probably Morricone. And then it will usually then switch over to like, also here's some synth. I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
right.
In a way that I think is just really fun and also evokes this movie's chaotic energy way better, which I think fits way better. Cause like the Good, the Bad, the Ugly, like the Ecstasy of the Gold, all that stuff is like designed for those long language shots of the desert.
Yes.
And we get those in this movie, but they're much shorter. And they're much less like the focus in this movie than those other things would be. So then we switch over to the kind of synthy stuff and the weirder stuff. And like you said, that one instrumental version of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood for the action. And I think it just lines up perfectly in a movie that is very much about like its movement and its energy.
Yeah. Also famously composed the theme song for The Thing. The very, very like moody and minimal kind of beautiful soundtrack for that as well.
Yeah, he's done like just he did a lot more than just spaghetti westerns for sure. He was all over the place. I think he might have just passed away very recently, actually. I'm not actually 100% sure.
He's
fucking
us?
Awesome.
No, he's still among us. He's 91 and still here, still in the world.
That's awesome.
Still looking good.
Still looking good. You know, they say Italians do it better, and they're correct. I'm just kidding.
Right. He did the Hateful Eight soundtrack. That's right. Because they brought him back for like, hey, we're making a Western. Yep. It's like, all right.
Yep.
Yeah. I think didn't he like do something with Daft Punk like 10 years ago, too?
Oh, did he?
I would believe it, frankly. He's still going. He's still making music. It's really cool. Hell yeah.
Yeah. I'm just looking at his most recent stuff. Yeah. Huh. The other thing too I wanted to say regarding like the editing and production of this movie is I just learned this. I was just looking through the Wikipedia. Apparently there's two endings to this movie.
Oh yeah.
Oh shit,
there's
really?
There's the international version, which is the one that is on iTunes, which is really annoying that the only place you can watch this movie legally is on iTunes. It was like a whole fucking thing. It meant that Danielle and I couldn't do the thing that we do where we share movies over Discord because iTunes has DRM. So if you try and capture your screen, it just shows a black screen. So like, guys.
I bought it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, same. You can only buy it on Amazon.
Oh,
so it's like 14 bucks. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I just rented it.
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, there are two versions. The one that showed in the Korean release is like a little longer and it shows Taegu getting up and he has like metal under his jacket. So he like survives.
Yeah.
And
the fistful of dollars ending.
Yeah. And then goes and kills Chang-yi. And then the Japanese army shows up and he, you know, scares them off with dynamite. And then he continues hunting for the treasure. But it's if you watch the credits of this movie, like you see that actually Tegu and Dewan survived.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a guy like marking off Park Chang-yi's wanted poster with the dead. And then like the Taegu has like a much higher bounty now.
It's seven times higher.
And Dewan just like sees it and like has a scarf over his face. So it's, he's just like kind of laying low and it's just like, oh, okay. So once again, he is chasing after him.
Which I don't think we specified. This movie ends with them all shooting the shit out of each other.
They all get fucking blasted. Yeah. They both actually, I think the good and the bad both shoot for Taegu when they first start shooting. And he just like pulls both of his guns out and is trying to shoot at them. And he gets like totally fucking...
They gang up on him.
Yeah, because he's like, they're like, oh, wait, this guy is like a fucking king. The goat.
That's how I feel about that actor.
Honestly,
to be completely honest with you.
Yeah. Song Kang-ho.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's great. Awesome. He's like really fun. He's I still need to see Parasite.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I know, I know.
Have you seen The Host?
Not seen The Host, but also a good one to see.
Yeah.
I would love to see that movie.
We watched the sort of beginning just to talk about with some of Colin's thoughts. I think what he's talking about isn't the very, very beginning, that sort of pre-sequence with the bad, but more the sort of beginning with the train and all these wide shots of the train. And then this gorgeous, long, probably, I imagine, Steadicam shot of behind the shoulders of going through the entire train with like this swagger of just like, I'm doing it, like, bro.
Cigarettes, candy,
rice cakes,
candy.
And then one guy is like, hey, I'll take seven. And he just pushes him back.
He's just like,
fucking leave me alone. And he's still calling for people to buy it.
And it's such an interesting shot because it's over the shoulders, but it's actually pretty high in a lot of places. Like it goes higher and it goes lower as he goes through different parts of the train. So it's like not only like a really cool Steadicam shot or what I imagine is a Steadicam shot, but also like is also doing a whole bunch with height and physical distance. So it's really, God, it's so good. It's really good. Sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack there. I just had to give more props to the cinematography. It's delicious.
Really good. And also the shot of Park Chang-yi on the tracks. Like just lighting a cigarette.
Yes. Yes.
Again, just like deeply anime. Just like, oh, I'm standing in the middle of a train track while a train is coming. Who cares?
He's a really cool guy. Like he's a cool guy. That's his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's his character arc in this. Is that
cool
he's just really cool and extremely hot.
Oh Jesus! His shirtless scene.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
right?
Jesus Christ! Holy fuck!
Lee Byung-hun used to be a model.
Yes.
Which probably explains his flair for just kind of like striking poses and kind of like cocking his head in these really, really striking ways. And he's also been in a number of American films as well. He was in the G.I. Joe movies that came out about 10 years ago.
Is he... What's his name? Storm Shadow?
He's Storm Shadow. Also was the T-1000 in Terminator Genesis in 2015.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh.
And
I did not.
No, me neither.
Yeah, it's okay.
So he's done some acting in the U.S. And he has several films that are on the list of highest grossing films in South Korea, one of them being this. And a few more, one of them including Master, which is like another action film that's sort of like a three character setup.
That's cool. Yeah, he's I mean, like we've said at this point, I think, like, we've talked a lot about Tegu and we talked about him very briefly in this movie, but just like, goddamn, just really, really fun when he's on screen. Again, not super deep, just because that's not what this movie is interested in doing. It's not like interested in making incredibly complex characters. They're all kind of archetypes of various styles. But when he's on screen, he really does just take over. It's kind of a cheesy opening, that very cheesy scene with him in the dark in that one guy's house and like talking about like bandits don't need train tickets, and he like takes his knife and cuts the train ticket in half and stuff like that. He's just like fucking chewing scenery so fucking much throughout this movie, especially at the beginning. And then we get to, I think, the crowning achievement of this movie and just cinematography in general.
Yes.
Yeah, where he's like, you know, in his room having a nightmare thinking about Tegu, which is the first flash we get to the idea that Tegu might be a badass. And then he wakes up and he's wearing, again, this movie takes place in like mid-1930s, late or early 1940s, and he's wearing like this fucking incredibly modern, super tight boxer briefs, like Calvin Klein looking ass.
This is just like
commercial. It really is.
An underwear commercial where he like throws a knife at a centipede on the wall and then shoots the knife deeper into the wall.
Oh my god. That scene.
Oh my god. His abs. Can we just talk about the abs? Can we just for
Jesus
one second?
Christ.
Just for a second.
I mean, we are verging into movie stars or hot territory.
I'm sorry.
Right.
But I mean, he do be cut though.
Yeah.
But that's like this. That's what this scene is trying to convey to us, though.
Yeah.
Also, is right. Like it's important to talk about in the context of the film and the language of cinematography.
Exactly. I just wanted to talk about the lighting on his
abs. He's a tortured sociopath who is hot, who is like calculated to appeal to a sort of depraved segment of the audience.
Or everyone, actually.
It even has that like kind of like not shoulder length but longer like deeply black hair and everything.
He
like
has
that
Ayori Yagami hair. He has cool like shrug your head and like his hair will flip over kind of hair.
But yeah, and then he takes like a sip of whiskey out of that glass with like two fingers held onto it and everything like that. That whole scene is just so gratuitous, and it is so perfect for what this movie is. And I enjoyed it a great deal.
Yeah,
just like I enjoyed the movie a great deal.
Yeah, it's extremely good. I need to bring up one bad thing, one negative, one potential negative about this movie. And I'm very sorry because this might just be me. But I have EMT brain and I can't not see things a certain way. And like, okay, all right, I'll just say some of the things that Do-won does to Tegu when he first kind of meets him and like captures him are like really horrifying. Like really horrifying. Like he causes like a horrific motorcycle accident, first of all, which always just scares me based on how many of those I've seen and attended. And then he like ties him up and basically drags him through the fucking desert. And then he like doesn't really help when he needs water. And it's just like, it's played for laughs because everything about Tegu until, you know, the end, until the reveals is like goofy as shit and very funny and very fun. But like, I really felt bad for him and it made me really not like Do-won. Like, let alone he's like a paper thin character of like Mr. Good Guy. But I think like what he does here is like really shitty. I just didn't like it.
Do-won is canceled.
I think he's canceled.
Shit. Actually, I was looking over like the critical reception of this movie, and apparently one of the chief complaints at the time, which almost feels trite by today's standards, even just like 12 years later, but was that the movie is almost too violent for its really kind of jaunty tone.
A lot of people die.
A lot of people get blown away.
And get fucked up. Like the scene where, what's his name? Mangil?
Yes. Oh my god,
that scene's horrifying.
It's bad.
That is a scene that I was like, this didn't need to be like, we get it. He's a bad guy. Like, you didn't need to be like stabbing him for like 15 straight minutes.
Right.
You know?
And then trying to cut his finger off and then having
and
to stop because
failing.
it's too dull.
Yeah.
That's rough. The scene in the fake brothel, the opium den thing.
Yeah.
The ass stuff.
Yeah, they definitely do kill two different men in this movie by shoving big giant spikes up their asses to death. That does happen.
Like they used to joke twice, which is kind of like, yeah. Right. Like there are these kids there who I guess he's trying to save. And he's just like, kids, close your eyes before I kick this spike up through this man's body in his mm-hmm. asshole. And then they do it again. And it's like, okay, well.
The second time they do it too, there is like definitely kind of like an almost, I don't know.
Yeah. He's just like, what?
Homophobic kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Because one of the kids shoved it up his butt and he's just like, what? And then, yeah. Of course, the Japanese army finds these two guys with spikes up their butts and it's just like, a pervert did this.
Right. It's just like that line.
This is also the scene too where I'm kind of conflicted about it because like I feel like there's a different way to frame this stuff in a way that I have traditionally enjoyed in the past and like think could be better because I love the series Golden Kamuy, which is if people have not heard of Golden Kamuy, this like and you like this movie, go read Golden Kamuy. It's a manga. There's also an anime out there. There's two seasons of it about like people trying to hunt for treasure in Hokkaido. It's an area of Japan that was like kind of a home to a indigenous people who lived near Japan, but weren't part of the Japanese Empire at first. And then actually a lot of Russians ended up there as well. Russian partisans fighting for independence and stuff moved there. But that is also a series that plays a lot with like hot guys getting into weird murdery hijinks with each other and like getting horny about murder and stuff.
Yeah.
But that is like an unapologetically like queer series with a lot of stuff like that. Whereas this, I think, is much more played for like a gay panicky kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. In a way. But if people see that scene and are like, I don't know, put off by it or whatever, but also like this movie in general and this movie's vibe, I really recommend people try Golden Kamuy.
Nice. Oh, that sounds, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think this movie was a lot of fun, and yeah. I've run out of things to say about it, personally.
I mean, I could probably go on for 4 hours about, like, every shot, but I won't, because that would be very, very boring for everyone but me, so I won't do that. Just beautiful. I that's the main thing that I kind of got from it, was just how fucking gorgeous this was, and how beautifully shot it was, and yes. How much fun at least two of our three leads had with it. Again, I feel bad for Zheng Wusung because I feel like he just didn't have that much to do as the Mr. Goody Two Shoes. Like, even though I think Mr. Goody Two Shoes is actually a total asshole based on what I've said earlier anyway, but yeah.
But he's a total asshole, and he's not framed like a total asshole the way Blondie is in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly understands that Blondie is an asshole.
He's a dick. Yeah, and it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't want this deer hanging out with me if I knew he, like, dragged somebody through the desert. It's really shitty. It's really mean. Sorry.
Right.
But yeah.
How about you, Merritt? Any final thoughts?
No, I think we've gone over pretty much everything. It's a fun movie. It is maybe like a little too much fun for one sitting.
Yes.
Almost.
For 2 hours and 10 minutes.
It's rich.
Yeah, it's a long movie. For an action movie that is, like Steven has said, it has way more action than most Westerns, and is in fact more of an action movie with like sort of a Western theming. It's a long movie. It's just kind of nonstop. So I did watch it in two sittings, but yeah, really, really enjoyable, just like fun action movie. And with some cool set pieces and characters.
Sometimes you just like a fun movie, you know?
Can we just have like a fun movie for once?
Just a fun movie.
We joke. We have a lot of fun here at fanbite.com. But at the same time, I will say one as my kind of like closing thought, I guess, about this. It is nice to have a reminder that, oh, yeah, people used to make like fun action mm-hmm. movies that weren't like completely bleached of all character and personality. Yep,
and that weren't just about like superheroes and like American military shit.
Yeah.
Yep. 100%. Yeah. That was. Yep. The Marvel movie comparison is definitely strong with this.
That's a for sure. Good point. I want to think about like watching this movie, like eating a massive ice cream sundae. Like you got to pace yourself. It's real sweet. It's real rich, but you got to pace yourself a little bit because you don't want to like go down you know, you wanna stay in it to win it. So yeah, that's my advice.
I really wanted to say something there, but I'm gonna hold that to myself. I'm gonna keep that for the director's cut of this.
All right.
Okay.
That's it. That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah, let's wrap up then. So go to fanbyte.com/podcasts to hear all our other shows, which we recently split up into a bunch of different feeds so that you can tailor your listening experience to your preferences.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Fanbyte Media to follow us there on Twitter, because Twitter won't give us Fanbyte. Just at Twitter, tell them to give us Fanbyte.
Yeah.
Steven is on Twitter at Steven Strom. Danielle is on Twitter at Danielle RI. I'm on Twitter at Merritt K. And does anyone else have anything before we go?
People can... Oh, sorry.
Steven, go for it.
I was going to say, check out fanbyte.com/Discord to join our Discord community. Yeah, we have a lot of really cool people all together there. And it's another great way, besides Twitter, to keep in touch with like all the different things that we're doing, because we like to notify people there and share pet pics a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, great pet pics, which you enjoy... to witness. So,
yes, I agree.
You adore to behold.
Yeah.
So, until next week.
I love these spin-off podcast ideas.
You adore to behold. Love it.
You adore to behold it. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.